Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on October 12th, 2019. This class is class 15 of 32 classes of our structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. This talk is on the Maha Dukkhakanda Sutta, the first of two talks on this sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
Today is, I think it's class 15 of 32 classes, which will actually be 34 or 35. Today's the first part of the Maha Dukkhakanda Sutta. The second part will be Tuesday, and then right after retreat, we're going to have 2 weeks on the Kula Dukkhakanda Sutta, the lesser discourse on dukkha, but it's no less important. Last week, what's today? It's last Tuesday. Our sutta was on the Dukkha Sutta, where the Buddha or Sariputta teaches the three forms of stress of dukkha. There's the stress of bodily pain, or really the stress of simply having a human body, the stress of fabrications, which is both the stress of mental difficulties or a troubled mind, but also the ongoing stress of living within a fabricated view of self. That ultimately the Dhamma resolves in within the self and going from a fabricated view of reality rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths to developing understanding. And that leads directly to today's sutta. Dukkha means stress, suffering, disappointment, unsatisfactory life experiences, minor pain, all the way up to extreme forms of suffering. It's all part of dukkha, and it's all part of having a human life. That second part of the title of today's sutta, next week's khanda, speaks directly to the five clinging aggregates. In other words, dukkha occurs within what the Buddha describes as the ongoing personal experience of suffering as five clinging aggregates: form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And that all points to how we resolve this. Another word for clinging aggregates in the old Pali and Sanskrit language was khanda, K-H-A-N-D-A, or skanda. It means the same thing. And that translates into a heap. Can be a khanda. Khanda means a heap, or even the root of a tree. And when you look at it in the right context as five clinging aggregates, these five clinging aggregates are, in the Buddha's words, would often refer to suffering this way, the whole mass of suffering. It's part of this heap that we call me, mine, ours, what we take ownership of. And that is the central theme that we're looking at during these 32 classes, is that it resolves within ourselves these wrong views. Today's sutta answers a question that the Sangha had. What's the differentiating characteristic between what the Buddha teaches and basically what everybody else was teaching? And it resolves in an understanding of suffering. And actually, we touched briefly on this earlier. Much of modern Buddhism and much of the modern world teaches us that we should embrace or join with our suffering. And we do this through analysis, through aggrandizing or over emphasizing ordinary suffering and making it something more simply by delving into it and so-called joining with it or exploring it or looking for insight in it. The Buddha said, recognize stress and suffering for what it is. It's rooted in ignorance. Let it go. Don't mess around with it. It's a khanda. It's a heap of stuff. The other reference to khanda is, khanda could mean the root of a tree. And the reference then is that all suffering is rooted in this whole mass of suffering, dukkha khanda. So. On one occasion, the Maha Dukkhakanda Sutta, on one occasion, the Buddha was staying in Savatthi in Jita's Grove, Anatha Pindika's monastery. Early in the morning, a group of disciples adjusted their robes and, carrying their bowls, their alms bowls, left for Savatthi. They quickly realized that it was too early for alms and decided to visit a group of wanderers from another sect. They exchanged courteous greetings and sat to one side. The wanderers from the other sect questioned the group from the Buddha Sangha. Friends, Gotama the Contemplative describes understanding sensuality as we do. Gotama describes understanding forms as we do. Gotama describes understanding feelings as we do. Friends, what is the difference, the distinguishing factor between his teaching and ours? An important point, huh? The Buddha's disciples, neither delighting nor disapproving of these words, decided to seek out their teacher to hear his words. They went for alms and then returned to the Buddha. They bowed to their teacher and sat to one side and told him what the wanderers of the other sect said. The Buddha replied, "Friends, when wanderers of other sects say this to you, you should ask them, what is the allure, the drawback, and the release with regards to sensuality? What is the allure, the drawback, and the release with regards to forms? What is the allure, the drawback, and the release with regards to feelings?" In other words, he's asking, how do you get entangled with these? Not that you know what it is or you can describe it externally outside of yourself. Well, I stubbed my toe. There's dukkha. That's all I need to know about dukkha. Or that person got me upset. That's dukkha. That's all I need to know. The Buddha's saying, understand how you get entangled with the world, entangled with dukkha. That's the important understanding, not to describe it. Anybody can describe it. When asked, these wanderers of other sects will be in trouble and will not be able to provide a reasonable answer. This understanding is simply beyond their knowledge. And of course, if you don't strive to understand something, you shouldn't be expected to know it. Friends, in the world of fabricated devas, maras, and brahmas, of contemplative and brahmins, Brahma is the overarching Hindu god, not to get too deep into it, and brahmins are the priests in that Hindu religion, royalty and commoners, I do not see anyone who could answer these questions aside from myself, my disciples, or someone who learned my Dhamma from a skillful disciple. This next section is called Understanding the Allure, the Drawback, and the Release of Clinging to Sensuality. The Buddha continues, now what is the allure of sensuality? There are five clinging fabrications of sensuality, forms interpreted by the eyes as agreeable, pleasing, endearing, and enticing, sounds interpreted by the ears as agreeable, pleasing, endearing, and enticing, aromas interpreted by the nose as agreeable, pleasing, endearing, and enticing, flavors interpreted by the tongue as agreeable, pleasing, endearing, and enticing, tactile sensations interpreted by the body as agreeable, pleasing, entertaining, and enticing. So right there, the Buddha is describing the six sense base, actually five of the six sense base, but he's also pointing out where the Dhamma is practiced, at the sixth sense base, at our interaction between the external world, and the external world could also be a fabrication in our thoughts because we've externalized it and objectified it, and our thinking, our ongoing thinking. And so if our, at the point of contact, if our thinking is still rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, this moment is going to simply reaffirm my ignorance, unless I have a framework of which to understand what's occurring in relation to the Four Noble Truths. Is that last statement understandable by everyone? Mm-hmm. At the point of contact. Mm-hmm. And so this points to the potential that each and every moment has for us as human beings. Remember, this is a Dhamma for human beings. If my mind is well concentrated and well framed, the refined mindfulness of holding in mind the Eightfold Path, then what is arising in this moment will be interpreted from right view and will contribute towards my awakening. If I'm still clinging to views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, no matter how sincere I might be on awakening or maybe just being a good, engaged, compassionate Buddhist, if my thinking is still rooted in ignorance, no matter what my motivation is for this moment, I can only continue ignorance. Why? Because no matter what is occurring, I'm interpreting from a mind rooted in ignorance. It can only produce that same effect. That's the problem. That's what the Buddha awakened to. How can I pierce this veil of ignorance that is common to every human being? How can I get past that? Another way of asking it, how does a person that's deluded know that they're deluded? Think about it. How would you? If all of your thinking is rooted in that delusion, there's no vehicle for understanding and having that aha moment. That's where I'm ignorant of. That's what the Buddha grappled with after his awakening, and that's why he presented it in Eightfold Path, to frame our thinking so we can recognize our own ignorance at the point of contact, at the sixth sense base. That's clear? Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to skip over some comments. The Buddha continues. Friends, whatever pleasure or happiness that one depends on, establishing through any of these five senses is the distracting allure of sensuality. Whatever pleasure or happiness that one depends on, establishing through any of these five senses is a distracting allure of sensuality. There's so much in there that it can simply be overlooked. Whatever one depends on. So the question we ask ourselves, what am I depending on in this moment for my happiness? Because for most human beings, it's an endless list of things that are constantly coming up, grabbing our attention in the moment. And if it's something that I can address right now, meaning if can I increase my grasping right now, I'm going to do it and I'm going to be distracted. Why? Because my mind isn't rooted in concentration and doesn't know how to perceive what's occurring. Is that clear? Seriously, I said a lot, is it? Because that's an important point. And again, in this moment, I'm either going to practice the Dhamma or I'm going to practice distraction. I'm either going to practice the Dhamma or I'm going to practice ignorance.
I have a question, John. Would that be the same thing as wanting peace of mind?
Boy, that's such a great question. Well, and it depends on intention. Mm-hmm. Because if here's the Eightfold Path. Because if my intention is to be, if my intention is simply to be a good human being, which is, we should, at the very basic, we should be mindful of being a good human being. Most of us are. But then we ask ourselves, how do we get into situations where individually I'm in conflict with people, and nationally and internationally we're in conflict with other people? Where does it arise? Is it because of my political views? No, it's not. Is it because of my nationalism? No, it's not. Is it because I'm following one party or another? No. I'm contributing to conflict in the world because of my ignorance. And that's the only place that it can be resolved. Ignorance of Four Noble Truths. I think I missed it just a little bit, Mary.
Yeah, because, I mean, to me, peace of mind would mean, regardless of what's going on around you,
yes,
you can be at peace with it. Whether you agree with it or disagree with it, yeah, you can still disagree with it, but it's happening, just, you know, it's happening.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Buddha and this sutta speaks directly to it in this whole course of teachings. The Buddha teaches that right view, right understanding, is a profound understanding of the First Noble Truth of stress and suffering. And he incorporates that description of awakened right view as he continues, saying right view understands the origination and the cessation of stress and suffering, meaning the origination and the cessation, excuse me, of ignorance. Right view has a profound understanding of the cessation of stress and suffering. Right view has a profound understanding of the path leading to the cessation. So all four noble truths are included in right view. And when the Buddha's talking about understanding, he's talking about having a direct experience with it, not an intellectual experience. And that's what leads to a calm and peaceful mind, no matter what's occurring in the world. We learn the difference between acceptance and approval at a very profound level. We don't have to accept what's occurring in the world. In fact, acceptance really becomes an aspect of awakening. We simply accept what's occurring because it's what's occurring. It's only a troubled mind rooted in ignorance that would insist that what's occurring and what has already occurred be different than it is. It can't be. But a mind rooted in understanding understands where the difficulties in the world arise from. Not an individual person, not an individual group, not the Muslims or the Catholics or the Buddhists or anyone. Suffering arises from ignorance. More?
I was just going to say, with the peace of mind piece, if one is like, and same thing that's saying in this sutta, but it reminds me of mindfulness of the six sense gates. and mindfulness of the characteristics of three marks of existence. So there, if one's noticing the impermanence with a wise mind of, you know, fabrications, that these are, you know, that mental fabrications and like this feeling that arises, there's thoughts that arises, they're all coming from the they're just arising and passing. So there's peace of mind at that point of, and like at that viewing gate, for lack of a better word. I mean, when we're, you would say it in the same, in more uniform language than I'm expressing.
You're doing fine.
But that's where, to me, so that's where the peace of mind is. It's a wise view, right view. And you can feel like the pull when you're not, there is not mindfulness at the sixth sense gates. And so, and it doesn't feel very peaceful.
Yes.
And so we're not attached to peace, right? But it's the view that changes the experience.
Yes, thank you. Peace is not an external quality. It's an internal, it's a quality of mind. And it rests in internal conditions and has nothing to do with external conditions. It rests in the condition of, of a well-concentrated mind supporting the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. Just as Maura said, right view is a profound understanding of stress and suffering. And from a person, a human being who was continually preoccupied with stress and I often say that the Buddha could have almost as accurately described the First Noble Truth as there is distraction, as saying there is dukkha, because it is the constant preoccupation with those things that are stressful in our lives that make them increasingly stressful and keep us distracted towards them. So a well-concentrated mind is necessary so that we're initially able to practice restraint at this sixth sense base, as we talk about often here. And as the Buddha is referring to, it's right here, right now. What's occurring right here, right now? It has nothing to do with what I've done in the past, and it has really little to do with what I'm going to do in the future, except to develop the Dhamma. More. Oh, I'm sorry, David.
Go back to the original discussion the Wanderers had. They used the words understanding. And obviously they had wrong understanding.
Yes.
But they are going through their day thinking they're being peaceful and helpful. But is it that they're asking the question for a wrong answer?
Yeah, well, for one thing, the Buddha understands what they're practicing. You know, they're in the same town, actually. So he knows who their teachers are and the Dharma that they're practicing. So they can use the term understanding, but the Buddha understands that their understanding is simply of an abstract idea that they're clinging to, rather than having the direct experience of understanding suffering. And he explains it in a little bit more detail. But that is a defining characteristic, isn't it? Between what the Buddha taught and really everything else, is this profound understanding of the nature of suffering arising from ignorance, not just understanding suffering. Every human being, I shouldn't make blanket statements, most every human being knows that they're suffering. In fact, that's the underlying motivation for most people to do things. The Buddha is not saying that you shouldn't even do those things. He's saying, but understand where suffering arises from. It's not because of the common conditions inherent in having a human life. That's the first arrow. We stick the second arrow in by reacting to what is normal, ordinary occurrences. Is that clear? Michael?
The way I understand it, is that peace of mind arises from practicing the Dhamma in a moment by moment, moment by moment.
Yes.
It's something that is not longed for, desired for, but occurs when the Dhamma is practiced and adhered to and the Eightfold Path is integrated.
Yes, thank you. And it's okay to desire to awaken. We just shouldn't be distracted by it. It's again, it's more of a Zen-like thing. Now we shouldn't want to awaken. Well, we should. There's a word for it called chanda, C-H-A-N-D-A, which means skillful desire. It's an internal motivation towards awakening, and that's something we should recognize and cultivate. It's okay to want to awaken. It's okay to use that. In fact, it's necessary. This is why I'm going to sit this afternoon when I'm so busy. I'm going to go sit first because it's my intention to awaken. This is part of my practice. I'm going to go to class. I'm going to study the Dhamma. That's all rooted in that. Michael.
Just in peace of mind, again, since we're on that topic, it's liberation.
It's what?
It's liberation.
Yes. Yes, and it's but it's specific liberation, too. Thank you, Michael. It's liberation from what?
Ignorance.
Yeah, wow. That's it. We can go home now. That's it.
John.
Yes, Julie.
Peace of mind is our essence, is it not? The essence? I mean, it's like, it's the core of our being. We have to remove all the other veils of stress and ignorance. And
yes.
In order to realize that that is our permanent being.
Well, thank you. And I wouldn't say it quite that way. There's nothing permanent in a being. And the idea of an inner essence of something infers that. And it's not something that the Buddha taught. There's no inner essence. There's just what's occurring in this present moment. And that belief that there's some kind of inner essence or a soul or a ground of being or an inner Buddhahood or a Buddha nature is something that the Buddha continually discounted because people wanted to go there. They want to establish these non-physical speculative realms for themselves because they couldn't reconcile that what is a self is just what's occurring right now, made up of six properties. So the as well concentrated and well informed as I am of the Eightfold Path and the Buddha's Dhamma, for me to believe that I'm simply shedding what's covering my perfect, pure inner essence is another speculative, imaginative idea, isn't it? It's not. And there doesn't, a mind that is stuck in those kind of fabrications can't even consider that there's not something of value within this six property person, except the Buddha teaches it isn't. And it's irrelevant to what's occurring right now. The idea that all I have to do, to use one example, is to follow 10 commandments. And when I die, I'm going to get rewarded for following those 10 commandments for the years that you've just missed your whole life, haven't you? Doing good works, but not realizing anything. So and I'm not picking on you. This is an important point.
Maybe I'm not saying it correctly. Yeah. I think that like the universe is made of that field of inner of peace. Everything around us is that peace. You know what I'm like. If you're in space, there's that peace.
Again, I don't mean to cut you off. Mm-hmm. But that's such a critical point. Are you in space?
I think we always are in space.
No. Where's your point of view right now?
Well, right now I'm inside the body of this mortal body of
yes.
existence right now.
That's what's important. Mm-hmm. The Buddha teaches to have a mind united with the body. We can, in fact, I understand what you're saying. From out in space, we look back out over the universe, mm-hmm. or maybe through a telescope. And all is peaceful, isn't it? But that's not reality.
It's like a fabric of the unifying fabric of everything. That's what I'm saying.
But again, there's the speculation. I don't want to argue with you, Julia.
Okay.
May or may not be true, but it's not something we can experience. Mm-hmm. And since it's not something we can experience, I can only imagine that a universal being is grand and peaceful and knows everything. Maybe, but it's not me. And even for me to aspire to something that I can never experience is stressful, isn't it? what the Buddha taught, and again, these types of things, this isn't, these ideas of cosmic consciousness and universal beings is something that was just as prevalent during the Buddha's time. He studied them. Alara Kalama and Udeka Ramaputta both taught similar themes. The Buddha understood them, he mastered them, and he said, this isn't it. He didn't say it's absolutely not true. He just said it's not important. It's a distraction from understanding what it is to be a human being. And a human being is not, a human being is a human being. They're having this life. And there's no essence to it. There's no inner something. There is only the peace that comes from understanding this is what's occurring. So it's a radically different view, isn't it, Julia? And I'm not trying to burst your bubble either.
I'm trying to understand it, actually. So
good.
It's not bursting my bubble.
Yeah, it's difficult because the Buddha spent so much time talking about avoiding speculative non-physical establishments, which is just that, thinking that there's an inner being, an inner soul, an inner essence. There simply isn't, and that's okay. Excuse me.
And it's difficult to not confuse that calm with this idea of the grand peace and the unity of things. It's very, very easy to fall into that, but still the whole Dhamma goes towards calm.
Yes, and it's easy because it does, the belief makes us feel good, doesn't it? The most prevalent form of modern Buddhism is Pure Land Buddhism. And again, I'm greatly simplified, but basically Pure Land Buddhism teaches that if you say this one particular chant continually and you keep that chant on your tongue, it's always there, no matter what you're doing. At least remember what it is. But most importantly, if that chant is on your lips when you die, you'll immediately be taken to, there's different names, Tulsita Heaven or Abhidhamma Buddha Heaven. You'll immediately be taken to Abhidhamma Buddha Heaven, and forever and ever, for all eternity, all your needs will be taken care of by Abhidhamma Buddha. There's a reason why millions and millions of people believe that, isn't it? Because all you have to do is believe it, and you've developed a calm and peaceful mind because you're good to go. It doesn't matter what you're doing, what the quality of your life is, what's occurring, what you understand. As long as you can keep that troubled mind away by saying this mantra over and over again, and you believe that once you die, everything is taken care of, why wouldn't you have a calm and peaceful mind? But again, you've just lost the opportunity to awaken by believing that.
I don't believe like in a heaven thing. I believe that we're made from the light particles that are part of the rest of the universe.
Yes.
So I don't believe that, you know, there's a heaven where you grow wings and, you know, you fly and all that stuff. You have to be good that's not what I'm like. So I'm not saying that.
Oh, I know you're not. Oh,
okay, good, because I didn't want you to think that.
No, I don't, but I would also say that...
That's like my Catholic upbringing, but that doesn't... I'm not that.
Yeah, I had trouble with that when I was a kid. But the point I'm making that the belief in a Christian heaven or a Buddhist heaven, any type of non-physical existence is a speculation. And it's something the Buddha continually teach, don't go there, because you're creating a fabricated existence for yourself. What happens to people who live in fabrication? We're prone to stress and suffering. 1 minute, Michael.
Just on that, isn't that non-becoming? Just what
it is. Saying? That's exactly. Thank you for picking it up. Again, the common phrase that the Buddha is non-becoming. We strive for becoming and non-becoming, meaning we strive for becoming further ignorant. This is the basic teaching in the dependent origination, and we strive for non-becoming. What does it mean? It means just this: to imagine an establishment for ourselves that is simply just that. It's just imagination. Why would we want to live in our imagination? Because the world is too stressful otherwise.
And we don't know. It's a speculation, like you said before.
Works, doesn't it? Again, the two most common forms would be Abhidhamma Buddhism. And the other common form is most of Mahayana and all of Mahayana and most of Theravada Buddhism, which teaches the same resolution in some type of non-physical reimagined or imagined plane of existence.
It's a better product.
It is. It's a much better product.
It's a burst of something that you get at the end versus this understanding that it's a little dull and this is what I got out of all this.
Well, yeah. Plus, this is work. I mean, this is work.
This is work.
Yes.
To have to work at living in a less than peaceful mind state. It's so easy to forget that this is your mind state. Accept it. Go on.
Yes, and even more so. It's addressing that my views that I've created about myself are wrong views. That's the hardest thing for any human being to do is to admit that they're wrong. We can do it. You know, we get caught in a cookie jar. That's okay. But these much more subtle levels of what I've used, my views to establish myself in the world, are so difficult because we own them, because we've joined with them. They become us. How can we let them go? The Buddha says we must let them go. Let me go to more.
I think I was just going to, at the risk of, following on this discussion, that I think we all understand, Julia, what you're saying, right? So, and that distinction, Don, is really important. But I think one can experience that without having to put a fabrication on top of it. In this moment, recognizing the impermanence and the not-self characteristics and the nature of clinging, abandoning clinging, there is a sense of ease with what's occurring. So that's as far as one needs to go. Without saying the ground of being is peaceful. We're all connected, or not that you're saying we're all connected.
I don't mean to cut you, but yes, all of those are speculative.
You can just leave that piece off.
All of it.
And leave it off.
But
and just
but,
keep integrating the Dhamma, and maybe like Michael said, this will arise naturally. It's
yes.
Something that we're...
And Julia brings up a good point, that because we do struggle with this, mm-hmm. we do, even at very subtle levels, when we start understanding the Dhamma, we still might be holding on to this idea that there's something wonderful. It's not that there's something not wonderful. We understand what a human being is. We're made up of four elements, the space property and the thinking property. There's nothing personal about it. But there's nothing holy or sacred about it. It's up to me to make, if I'm believing in the sacred, it's up to me to make this a sacred life based on what I understand, not what I can acquire from merit or anything else like that.
Peace isn't sacred.
Pardon me?
Peace isn't sacred.
Peace is. I mean, that's. But the natural state of a human being, an awakened human being, is peace. It's not something extraordinary.
That's right.
It took this discussion and everybody to be a part of it to get to that point.
Yes, that's it.
That's the point, is to recognize as an awakened human being, there's nothing that I should be disturbed about because I understand it. I'm not disturbed because I understand it. And that's true about anything. If we understand a situation, there's nothing disturbing about it. Quickly, Michael, I don't mean to cut you off, but.
Okay. What really comes through with this, to actually, I think to understand it, this is the way I think of it, and it's, the Buddha actually was known for having such great concentration.
Yep.
Concentration, and when you were talking about the subtle aspects of life and the things that arise in our mind all the time, it's how far do you go? Well, there's a disturbed mind, which is Mara, right? It's Mara? Is that
Mara, yes.
Mara. Okay, so Mara exists. So that we can recognize that there is a process by which we concentrate down to the whatever, no matter how subtle something is, occurrence, and we concentrate, and that concentration leads us to an understanding of right and wrong thought, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you also. It encompasses everything in the Eightfold Path, okay? And with such deep concentration, okay, it's not an easy existence to go through it, but like it, and have such refined concentration, okay? But the Buddha obviously was an exceptional being who had such ability to concentrate. So I look at it as like cultivation of that concentration on a moment by moment unfolding reality, which keeps us here presently in this present, makes it present. So, okay?
Yes.
Or being with that concentration, and if we're tuned in on that, we don't think about the past. We don't have time to think about the past. We don't think about the future. We think about now and refining that concentration.
Yes. That's the point of concentration within the Buddha's Dhamma. That's the point of why we meditate, why we have a jhana practice, because it supports the integration and the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. That's why we do it. So it gets to this point. Thank you, Michael. I got my spot now. Let me just read that again. Friends, whatever pleasure or happiness that one depends on establishing through any of these five senses is a distracting allure of sensuality. Now, what is the drawback of sensuality? Here is an example. When one's occupation, distracting, when one's occupation, whether accounting or plowing, whether trading goods or attending to cattle, whether archer or attending a king, whatever one's occupation, they are subject to changing weather, to harassment by insects, to dying from thirst and hunger, and the whole mass of suffering. The Buddha is saying, no matter what your position in life, you're going to have this experience. Yeah. Somebody more?
Oh, no, I'm just laughing. Oh, okay. Tolerate jokes. <Jolly, jolly. laughs>
This drawback of sensuality, this mass of stress and suffering that is visible here and now, right here, right now, again, the Buddha is pointing out at the point of contact, that is visible here and now, has sensuality as its source, and its establishment. Simply put, the drawback of sensuality. What the Buddha is saying basically is, the drawback of sensuality is
sensuality.
Yeah. and sensuality, I think, is different than the normal human.
I'm going to get into that. Where does sensuality occur? Where do we experience sensuality?
Senses.
Now, if a person gains little while striving and make an effort, they will be sorrowful and regretful. They will grieve and become destroyed. The Buddha is simply pointing out that sometimes, no matter how righteous our efforts are, no matter how much we strive, the results can be disappointing. There's no guarantee of happiness there. But when we believe so, we are setting ourselves up to be disappointed. The Buddha continues, making the quote about that person that has put all these efforts in. All of my efforts have been useless and fruitless. As opposed to a person who engages in the world without these speculative achievements, simply recognizes, well, this is what I did, and this is the result of it. And they move on to the next moment. They might be disappointed in that moment, but there's nothing taken personally. And so they're free to experience it however it's occurring, rather than take a self-referential view, blame themselves, and probably blame the world or individuals for how they're feeling. Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, ongoing consciousness.
Would they even be disappointed?
It depends. Disappointment is a common human emotion, just like fear, just like anger. So an awakened human being sees a bear coming out of the woods chasing him, they're going to be skillfully fearful.
Fearful, yes. But
and so you'll move out of the way. Well, you might also be disappointed because it ate your lunch. But that's, you're disappointed that it ate
but
your lunch.
Only an aspect of mine will be disappointed. It was just an aspect.
Well, but you'll move on, and you'll grab another bag of nuts or whatever you have to do. It's just simply what's occurring. It's not that goddamn bear. Can't we got to get rid of all the bears because it ate my... I live in a world with bears. I mean, it's just radical acceptance. I don't need to approve that the bear chased me and ate my lunch. It's simply, in fact, it would be an interesting thing to experience it, as long as you got through it okay.
You may not want to try that.
No.
I did. I wrestled the bear once. I did. It was that. I should tell the story now that I said it. Rob. Down in Wildwood, they had these. It was an attraction. If you, I think you got $10 or something.
No.
If you agree to wrestle the bear, you get $10. And I was drunk, and I could always use $10.
Right.
So I agreed to it. And it was just like it's probably about 100-pound bear that was declawed and defanged. And the worst thing about it was that it stunk like a bear. And I was a wrestler, so I could wrestle a little bit. And the bear kind of grunted and just laid on top of me, and that was the end of that. But I wrestled the bear. Maury, you had something to say before I passed on that.
What an evolution. From wrestling bears to...
I think something more that we can... I think that what you're pointing to and that we all can relate to as human beings is a situation where the... I think Sariputta is dying, and he was a well-loved member of the Sangha, and the Buddha said, yes, I'm disappointed that our beloved, the heartwood, one of the beautiful heartwoods of the Dhamma is leaving us.
Okay.
And yes, I have understanding that this is part of the way that the human life goes. And yes, at the same time.
Yeah, I always see an expectation at the bottom of disappointment.
Well, but you can also simply be disappointed about what's occurred. I think we're getting a little bit too deep into the weeds about words. It just simply means you're a human being that you don't take anything personally. So disappointment is an immediate feeling, or it can be an immediate feeling, or it can be something that is stuck in the past and pushing us towards the future.
Yeah. Okay.
The Buddha continues, all of my efforts, just saying that again, all of my efforts have been useless and fruitless. This reaction, as the Buddha says, this reaction is also a drawback of sensuality. This mass of stress and suffering that is visible here and now has sensuality as its source and its establishment. Simply put, the drawback is sensuality. The Buddha continues, if a person gains wealth while striving and making efforts, they will experience distress protecting their wealth. How can I keep my wealth from kings and thieves? How will I protect my wealth from fire or from floods? How will I protect my wealth from greedy heirs? I'm going through that right now. Even as they protect their wealth, kings and thieves make off with it.
Well, how do you put kings and thieves right next to each other?
Yeah. Fire and floods destroy it, and greedy heirs make off with it. They then will be sorrowful and regretful. They will grieve and become distraught. What was once mine is gone. That all speaks with joining with phenomena and attempting to gain ownership of it. The Buddha continues, this drawback of sensuality, this mass of stress and suffering that is visible here and now, has sensuality as its source and its establishment. Simply put, the drawback is sensuality. It is preoccupation with sensuality as the reason, the source, the cause, that kings quarrel with kings, nobles quarrel with nobles, Brahmins with Brahmins, householders with householders, parents with children, children with parents, children with siblings, and friends with friends. When conflicted, they will attack. They will attack each other with fire. I'm sorry. They will attack each other with fists or sticks or clubs or knives, and they incur extreme pain or death. Here again is the drawback of sensuality. Look at just the profundity of what the Buddha said. He's basically saying all the conflict in the world arise from this preoccupation with sensuality, with getting things that are pleasing or safe or that I need or whatever it might be, and avoiding, sensuality is also avoiding those things that are unpleasing to my senses. And we simply get caught up in it. We lose our minds and we lose our bodies. And we live our lives in an ideology and a fabrication of what human life should be. There is stress.
John,
yes, Jeff?
Just to stop off at sensuality, I think it's one of the things that we're hardwired for, because we're hardwired above almost everything to reproduce and sensuality, attraction.
Yep.
So I'm not sure that they conceive things the way we do, you know.
Who's they?
The people in the Buddhist time.
Oh, that's he's making the point that that is the difference. They can, we can see it and they can't, basically. Mm-hmm. And again, coming back to that, we can't avoid sensuality as human beings.
That's what I'm saying. Just,
but what we can learn is to practice restraint. That's the whole point of the Dhamma. It doesn't that, well, we're sensual beings and so we're lost. The brilliance of the Buddha is he understood a human being so well that the original vehicle for our suffering is the same vehicle we take control of it to end our suffering. And it all occurs with the way we think. So there's nothing right or wrong about sensuality. It, when we engage with our own human sensuality with a mind rooted in ignorance, it can only increase stress and suffering. So again, the things that are sensually pleasing, it's not that they're bad, it's that we join with them, we cling to them, rather than live life in an impersonal way. So you brought up a great point, Jay. Did that bring a little clarity as well?
Just meant to be a footnote that, you know, there are things about being a person that are speculative and there are things that are pretty obvious. And, you know, sensuality, sex, reproduction, all very central to our experience. When you become
obsessed,
these politicians you hear about who are chasing young women all the time and stuff, well, then it's aberrant behavior, something that maybe be avoided, but the basic...
Well, it can't be avoided by people that are doing it, or they wouldn't do it. Right. They're doing it because their minds are rooted in... You can say, well, they're perverts, but that doesn't even describe the problem, does it? It describes the actions. The problem is ignorance.
Although it's more than that, because it can also be that there's a chemical imbalance in the brain.
That could be.
Yeah, and that's why their behavior is so...
There could be. But the general point here, even if it's interesting when people talk about sensuality, and I'm not singling you out. Most of the time we're thinking about sex when we hear the word, right? Mm-hmm. Sensuality, sex. That's only one thing, one aspect of it. And people live very well, by the way, without sex. It's not a requirement for a happy human life. A lot of people would, Masters and Johnson would probably hang me if they're still around. But people with the right mental framework, you can practice restraint at anything. It doesn't mean that sex is bad either, by the way. But it should be practiced with restraint, shouldn't it? And it should be, I don't want to get too deep. We gotta cut down a little bit on the commentary. We're never gonna get through this. So, and after that, let's keep it till we go around the room. More.
So, it seems to me, though, very specifically in this sutta, when the Buddha is saying sensuality, he is very specifically just referring to the six sense bases.
Yeah,
so
but
we confuse. That's what I was trying to say before. Sensuality has an idea. Yes, they are the same thing. If you looked it up in the Webster's dictionary, but we think of sensuality as silks and this and being this. Sensuality means what's coming in, and if there's mindfulness of the six sense bases, you understand it with wisdom. What's coming in, so you can still experience the pleasure, but you understand it. So. That's all I'm getting at.
Thank you, Mark.
You know.
It is preoccupation with sensuality as the reason, the source, the cause, that human beings wear armor, use swords, spears, and arrows while charging in formation into battle with other human beings. So why do we have war? The Buddha just taught us why we have war. With spears and arrows flying, with swords flashing, they are wounded, their heads cut off, ensuring extreme pain and death. Here again is a drawback of sensuality. This massive stress and suffering that is visible here and now has sensuality as its source and its establishment. Simply put, the drawback is sensuality. Friends, it is preoccupation with sensuality as the reason, the source, the cause that human beings take what is not theirs, they ambush others, they commit adultery, and when caught, kings have them tortured for their misdeeds. They are flogged and beaten with clubs, their hands and feet cut off, their ears and noses too. They are subjected to many indignities and deprivations. Here again, this is the drawback of sensuality. This massive stress and suffering that is visible here and now has sensuality as its source and its establishment. Simply put, the drawback is sensuality. Friends, it is preoccupation with sensuality as the reason, the source, the cause that human beings engage in bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. Having lived the lives as such upon death, this is so important, having lived the lives as such upon death and the breakup of the body, there is only continued deprivation. So you think the Buddha's talking about another life? Continued deprivation?
No.
Yes, no?
No.
No.
Definitely. No.
What is he referring to then?
The body just, it starts to rot and decay.
That's it. And so people have taken that one line and say, yeah, oh, the Buddha's teaching reincarnation. And he describes it too in many suttas. The deprivation of a body just laying out there is picked apart by animals, etc., and it slowly decomposes and it oozes all kinds of unpleasant things. That's a deprivation that even upon death, it continues.
You're not getting away from it.
And if you have self-identified with that body, the thought of your body going through that is troubling, isn't it? When the truth of the matter is, that's just as impersonal as your entire physical life was. It's just an important teaching on that.
Mm-hmm.
Here again is the drawback of sensuality, this mass of stress and suffering that is now only continued deprivation that has sensuality as its source and its establishment. Simply put, the drawback is sensuality. And again, this is just occurring within a person's mind, but the Buddha is identifying that as troubling. Why? Because it's a fabricated view. And what, friends, is the release from sensuality? The subduing of passion for sensuality. That's the Dhamma, those two lines. The subduing of passion for sensuality. Excuse me. The subduing of craving for sensuality. The abandoning of passion for sensuality. The abandoning of craving for sensuality. This is the release from sensuality. So again, there's nothing ambiguous about what the Buddha is teaching. Friends, I say to you, any contemplatives or Brahmins who do not understand sensuality as it truly is, who do not understand the allure as allure, who do not understand the drawback as drawback, who do not understand the release from sensuality as release, could only understand sensuality or rouse in others in accordance with what they believe and what they practice. So some people get upset when I say, if you're going to be a Dhamma teacher, teach the Dhamma, because to do things, to do otherwise is cruel. That's what the Buddha was saying 2,600 years ago. We don't need his words to say to understand that. But to mislead people in Dhamma practice, I think, is the cruelest thing anybody can do. As release, could only understand sensuality or arouse in others in accordance with what they believe and what they practice. It is impossible for them to understand sensuality as sensuality. Because what you're teaching is rooted in using your senses to reaffirm your own ignorance. But friends, I say to you, any contemplatives or Brahmins who do understand sensuality as it truly is, who understands the allure as allure, who understands the drawback as drawback, who understand the release from sensuality as release, would themselves understand sensuality and rouse understanding in others in accordance with what they believe. In other words, in accordance with the Dhamma, and what they practice. It is now possible for them to understand sensuality as sensuality. It all depends on what we're practicing. That's part one. We'll finish this on Tuesday. But that's enough for one day, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Let's go around the room.
Thank you, John.
See you, Brett. Thank you for the help with the debris and all that stuff, too. I'll see you next week. Good morning, Jen.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So I think in this sutta, the Buddha is sort of pointing at sensuality as the problem. And when you're listening to that with a mind that is rooted in ignorance, you might immediately kind of jump on sensuality as the enemy.
Yep.
And say to yourself, now I need to just get rid of sensuality and everything will be fine. If I could just get rid of sensuality, and then the mind starts reeling against sensuality and becoming averse to sensuality and saying, oh, well, how could I get rid of sensuality? Like, that's part of my hardwiring. And how do I, you know, and then we get into this argument about what sensuality is and how you define sensuality. And that's an example of just getting lost. The Buddha isn't saying get rid of sensuality.
No, not at all.
He's just saying see it, recognize it, and don't become obsessed by it.
Yes, be informed through your senses from a mind resting in wisdom, not ignorance.
When you see sensuality, if you notice yourself becoming averse to it, or you notice yourself becoming craving after it,
yes,
and recognize that.
And where do we know it? In the form, in the body? And a mind that is reacting is going to be felt in the body. Notice that. Realize this is not me, this is not mine. Take a breath and go into the next moment. Mm-hmm. Meaning avoid any type of ascetic practice completely. Remember, the Buddha practiced all these severe ascetic practices, which is still practiced today. That, well, the problem in this misunderstanding of the problem is sensuality and craving. So if I just cut off my senses, that's mm-hmm. the answer. That's asceticism. And it's still going on in very severe ways. But there's many aspects of asceticism that have become the fabric of... We don't do silent retreats for that reason. That's a form of asceticism. That forced silence for long periods of time is just that. And it's nothing else. People make excuses for it. But anytime you deny the senses, and in fact, you're really denying three senses when you decide to not speak for a period of time, and there's no Dhamma there. There's no opportunity for it. But it's even deeper than that. Think of the strategies that we do because we don't understand something. We don't understand our sensuality. We feel like we're, and many people are out of control as far as their sensory input is. So the solution is not to understand it. The solution is to cut it off. It doesn't work, does it? Whether you are a drug addict or an alcoholic or somebody who's just craving Cheetos. Or craving endless idle conversation, so you're always on the phone or on. I mean, that it's the same addiction, isn't it? And it's a need for distraction right here, right now. I cannot stand the quality of my mind. I need something to distract me from it. And that's what we do. There's so much self-loathing in that whole notion, but it's simply because we don't understand who we are that we're driven to these extreme practices. So, thank you, Jen. Mm-hmm. Lorna.
Thank you for your teaching. Oh, such a noble time.
I'm glad you're here today. Well, let me get to Mary. Mary, how are you? I need to. Can you unmute yourself?
There you are.
How are you, Mary?
Good. Good morning, everyone.
Morning, Mary.
somewhere you said something about that this is active, not passive. And that kind of stayed with me. beneficial to understanding the subtleties of today's sutta. You know, that even restraint is active and managing everything at the sixth sense base where the suffering occurs is active. And it also speaks to, you know, this is not an easy practice. It may appear passive on the outside, but it's very active. And so we're leaning in to become more aware of the subtlety of what's happening at the sixth sense base, and that's a very active process. I guess that's what I had to do.
thank you Mary, it's so important. The word karma means action, again very misunderstood in modern Buddhism. But that points directly to the acting to awaken, meaning using what's occurring right now. The present moment unfolding is my karma. And if I'm acting within the framework of the Eightfold Path, I'm taking a positive, I'm taking a intentionally motivational direction in where I'm going. I'm acting in it. That again, that's the difference between even something that Julia brought up earlier, the establishing myself in some kind of speculative, imaginative realm is passive, isn't it? It's just occurred in my imagination. I guess there's some action there, but it's completely passive. I'm not doing anything that's going to have any realistic effect on me. The Buddha, everything we do within the Dhamma is significant in that if it's framed by the Eightfold Path, it will have the effect that we hope it has. I'm going to go to Ram first, just because you've got a lot of leave.
So we're going to have a conversation on dukkha, and the first thing that comes up is sensuality. And points again that dukkha also occurs right at the sixth sense gate.
Yep.
And this is also where it ends.
Mm. Yep. And who's in control of that? I don't mean to interrupt you, but because I know you're going to have a good answer. Who's in control of the sixth sense base?
We are.
Yeah.
And this is where restraint, you know, the control is restraint at the sixth sense gate. This is the end of dukkha.
Yep.
As simple as that.
It is that simple. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Tim.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
Every time I read the sutta, it's like this is the attack on the self, on the ego. And and we saw that response today, I think. And rightly so. The Dhamma teaches, for me, the guidelines, the proper steps to take when confronted with these sensual, these sensual things, whether it's sight, sound, taste, what have you. You and I have talked about this before. I really like science a lot.
I do too, by the way, despite our conversation.
But I need to use, and I do, the framework to keep it in line, because we all need to stop time traveling. And what I mean by that,
that's right.
A distracted mind really is time traveling.
Yep.
Whether it's in the past or in the future, even 2 minutes in the future, what I'm going to do. And to keep it right here, those distractions will leave. And the ego, the self, wants to plan, wants to put these things in neat little pockets. And when we don't have those pockets answered, that's the danger of salvific things coming forward. And when we talk about what happens to us when we die, you know, the ego cannot fathom this ending, this thing called Tim ending. The thing that Buddha's saying is we don't know. So there's no reason to even worry about it. There's no reason to think about it. There's no reason to even go into the past to try to figure it out. You'll get there.
Yeah.
And then
it's the most practical teaching ever.
And that's it. Yeah. And that six, that sutta is within that, the sixth sense base there is basically saying all those things. We're like very detached from nature. We're very detached from our environment as humans. More, you know, even in the Buddhist time, we're in a building. We're not outside. We're not part of the flow. And that is a struggle. That's a struggle that the self has. And so we're trying to figure all that out. So this sutta to me, I read over and over and over again, because it brings me perspective all the time and keeps me focused on the Eightfold Path. Because I think, unless I'm correct, please tell me if I'm not getting this, the Buddha was just saying, just stay on that path.
It was saying just that. So. Thank you. I emphasize it because the Buddha emphasized it. It's this path. It's nothing else. This is what we do, and this is why we do it, and this is what we look for. And it's nothing beyond that. You know, and you said something else I wanted to comment on, but I forgot it. But thank you. Morning, Lisa.
Morning, John. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for asking.
always good to be here, and just my mind feels like it's exploding with all the different ideas, although it's just a lot of things that are said in different ways.
Yeah.
Which is good. You keep repeating things, and then something gets through. It's said in just the right way that different people can understand. You have mentioned several times about the word sensuality, referring to the five senses and consciousness, the system, the thinking. So it encompasses all that. It seems like people have this tendency to want to avoid bad things, and they have another tendency to want to go after things that are going to satisfy one of their senses or several of them, and not wanting that to end, which is non-acceptance of the reality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it seems frantic in our society.
Yeah.
And thoughtless.
Yep. Or another word for that is mindless.
And then also knowing, like what you said about, you know, decomposition of living things and all that, because we're covered in the largest organ in the body, which is the skin, but, you know, it's covering up like all the icky weird things that are always going on inside, and it's kind of like, I don't know how to describe this, is that, you know, we walk around and not only, you know, do we not even want to know kind of what's going on inside, like, I don't want to think about that, you know, but even things on our skin, so people cover themselves in all these beautiful clothes to deny their, it's like denying their humanity,
mm-hmm.
and you know, a king wearing a crown, and it's just pretending to be something you're not. But the thing about that, we, you know, we go after beauty and we admire things, but the moonflower, obviously it's wilting. It, you could see that happen before your very eyes. So at 8 o'clock, it was cut, and it was perfect and beautiful. It doesn't last long anyway, but when you cut it, already by the time we got here, it had, you know, started to change. And that's what happens to it. It just shrivels up and curls up and nothing. It's not, there's still beauty in it, but, you know, kind of not the same thing. And I think that's the way things are. We need to accept that. I think Buddhists are saying there's nothing wrong with, you know, admiring and loving, but it's going to pass. It's not always going to be that way. And just enjoy for what it is, and then go on. I like what you said about the thinking or something is about time travel. Because when you daydream, you're always, whatever, you come back and say, oh, I was thinking about what I hoped was going to happen, or mulling over something that did happen before, instead of just being right here. Because if you're there or there, then you're not living. So I think Buddha wanted us to just live and not say, I can't wait till. You know, people say, I just can't wait till, and then fill in the blank.
Well, yeah, thank
so,
you.
So you're, well, then you're wasting your now.
You're wasting your life. Thank you. That's the essence of a conditioned mind, to think that, you know, I'm always time traveling, either in the past or the future. The Buddha taught a Dhamma to unite the mind in its body and keep it there. Why? Because that's the only way we can live a life, is to actually be here for our life, right? We got to be in our body. We got to be mindful of what's occurring. And we can't do that if we're time traveling, if we're stuck in the past, if this was a better experience yesterday, or I hope that tomorrow I get even prettier flowers, whatever it might be, we've lost our mind. Even if it's a pleasant thought, even if it's a loving thought, if it's not in our body at the moment, if it's not relating to what's occurring, we've lost our mind. And there is stress. It's not right, wrong, right or wrong. If we're concerned about understanding stress, as the Buddha teaches, we understand that we're out of our minds now. Let's regain it. That's the ultimate stressor, is not being in your mind. Good morning, David.
Good morning, John. I'm also.
Good morning, Maura.
I think I said enough, and I appreciate everyone's thoughts and comments, and I think thoughts and comments are helpful in understanding.
I think so, too. It's really what sets this Sangha apart. So, mm-hmm. Glad you're here. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning, John. Thank you very much for the teaching of the Buddha and your way of presenting it.
Thank you. Morning, Michael.
Good morning, John. I'll just say this quickly, okay?
I didn't mean to get people, I just meant we need to keep the class going.
I feel stressed. Don't.
Everybody who's spoken has contributed greatly to our class, as always. So, thank you.
I'll just, the way, correct me if I'm wrong, always.
I always do.
yes, and I learned from it. So, it doesn't matter what situation we're in, where we are, anything that we encounter, everything, again, unfolds moment by moment, whether it's here, at home, in public, at an event, wherever, okay? Whatever occurs, it's going to occur. So when it does occur, and no matter, again, the magnitude of it, again, doesn't even matter if it's of great or lesser. What to do then? My interpretation of this is that, like, you remain in deep concentration, or you refine your concentration, okay, through meditation and practicing of the Dhamma, living the Dhamma. And no matter what unfolds and occurs, we respond to that moment, framed, within the framework of the Eightfold Path, which is something that, once you understand the Eightfold Path, it becomes more of a natural thing to do, and you don't even have to exercise as much restraint. The more integrated you become with the Eightfold Path, although there always will be a moment of restraint, the right action comes forward. It flows from you. Doing so and operating from there as life unfolds and occurs, it creates this slow process of liberation we're freeing our mind of ignorance.
Yep.
And again, just ending there, again, no, let's make no doubt about this. This Dhamma, okay, the Buddha's Dhamma, is not an easy path. It's a path of deep concentration, and again, that occurs with the unfolding of every moment and occurrence that we encounter.
Yeah. Wow, beautifully said, Michael. There's nothing I would change to that. Mm-hmm. Perfect. Except maybe that it is a difficult path. But it's much easier than living in ignorance.
Very true, very true.
We're so familiar, and actually we get a mind that's enamored with its own thoughts is a very lazy mind. And there's a lot of examples of that today. People with really good minds, but they're lazy in their thinking, so they keep creating stress for themselves and others. That's it, So another counter to a lazy mind is a well-concentrated mind, because the more concentrated the mind is, and the more it's framed by the Eightfold Path, the more useful and skillful its thoughts are. So this underlying conversation that we all have, thoughts are always flowing, are now rooted in wisdom. And so they're producing results that are rooted in wisdom in the moment. This is how the Dhamma works. And it's just that way. Thank you. Morning, Kevin. Good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. Thank you so much for this teaching. And thank everybody for their wise and insightful comments. It's wonderful. Mm. And I just wanted to add, it is in the future, but I want to wish you a great retreat next weekend.
Thank you. We're going to miss you not being here.
Miss it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'll talk about that in a second. Glad you're here. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning. And we have been all over the universe today, you know, lots of things. And I want to thank everybody. Thank you, John, for the mental stimulation, because it's a rare thing nowadays. I'm not in an academic environment where people are philosophizing or parsing the bits of reality and humanity every day. But it's a treat. It's a little bit of a tune-up coming here, and you know, like, wow.
That's a good way to put it.
So it was a good day.
It was. I'm glad you joined us. Good morning, Mary.
It's great to be here again. Your teachings are always so beneficial to me. They ratchet me down and ground me again, and very helpful. Thank you.
I'm glad you were here. So we'll finish this talk on the Mahadukkakhana Sutta on Tuesday. There will not be a class next Saturday, but the next sutta on dukkha, the Kula Dukkakhana Sutta, will be next Tuesday and Saturday too. So it's a remarkable series of three talks on this heart of the matter that resolves, as we started this study, within the self. Everything the Buddha taught is experienced and resolved within itself. There's nothing external that can act on us, and there's nothing external that will act on us. It's all up to us. That is such a liberating thought to truly understand. It's all up to us how we experience this life. The experiences of life aren't up to us, many of them, but our experience of that is entirely up to us. We can maintain a calm and peaceful mind rooted in understanding, or we can continue to lose our minds, even if it's in very subtle, comfortable, familiar ways. It doesn't really matter. So, thank you for a wonderful class. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. And there's still some room on the retreat. If anybody wants to join us, please do so. And these are the words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta from the Buddha. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace. Thank you, Mary, for joining.
Mary, bye, John. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye,
Mary.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.